This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday, so that means it's time for our week in review, and we will begin with President Obama. He gave his final press conference of the year this afternoon, and in it, the president took a question about the still-open U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay. Closing it is an unfinished promise of his presidency, and the president in his answer linked that to today's fears about ISIS and terrorism.
Guantanamo continues to be one of the key magnets for jihadi recruitment. You know, to Roberta's question earlier about how do they propagandize and convince somebody here in the United States who may not have a criminal record or a history of terrorist activity to start shooting, this is part of what they feed, this notion of a gross injustice, that America's not living up to its professed ideals.
The president travels today to California for a private meeting tonight with the families of victims of the San Bernardino attack earlier this month. We'll talk about that and the week's other news today with Jabari Asim. He's executive director of the Crisis magazine. Jabari Asim, good to have you back with us.
Thank you.
Also with us is John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University. John, welcome back to you.
Good to be here.
Okay, so let's first start off briefly with the president's press conference today. Obviously took a number of questions about ISIS and terrorism. I'm just wondering your first thoughts on what the president said and what impact do you think this latest sort of heightened fear and tension around terrorism in the United States, you know, may be having on this last part of his presidency. And John, let's start with you.
Well, I think Obama took the Hippocratic Oath before he went into the press conference. You know, first, do no harm. Get out of town before anything bad happens. Beyond that, I think he's seen his numbers, his approval numbers, slip since Paris and San Bernardino, because I don't think the public in general has felt that he is involved enough, that he is alarmed enough. And actually, there was a quote from him in the New York Times on the web this morning. Meeting with some news columnists, and he said he did not see enough cable television to fully appreciate the anxiety after the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino. So I think that this press conference, in a way, is trying to make up some ground here that he clearly has lost with the public. If you look at his numbers, he was at 48% approval. He's down to 43%.
Yeah. Jabari?
Yeah, I think this is one of those instances where you can see where the president's traditionally calm demeanor sometimes works against him.
Right.
I mean, sometimes it's really impressive to see it, the way he keeps a cool head when all others around him are losing theirs. But on another issue that he mentioned, I think that calm demeanor also raises questions. When he talked about pledging to reform the criminal justice system,
mm-hmm.
there are a number of communities who feel as intensely about that particular issue as others feel about national security. And they also have complained that he sometimes seems a little not sufficiently moved by the urgency of the moment.
He expressed some optimism about exactly that, about criminal justice reform and a couple other things, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership today. He said he had optimism on a, quote, narrow set of issues. I mean, do you think he's right to be optimistic on criminal justice reform?
I was surprised. I thought that was kind of a strong stance to take. I think healthy skepticism is probably the best attitude anyone could hope to have.
Okay. So, John, let me turn back to you about one more thing regarding terrorism and whether or not the president sort of, I mean, he might have his finger on the pulse of how America feels, but he may not be communicating it, because the president that we saw today in the press conference and his calm, no drama Obama demeanor is pretty much diametrically opposed to what we saw, say, in the GOP debate a little earlier, which was doom and gloom, if I've ever seen it, about, you know, protect your children, protect your families.
And unbridled testosterone as well. I mean, they were up there. They didn't have anything in particular to say about terrorism. They didn't have any particular policy or approach to it. All they were trying to do is out-tough the other one in terms of talk. And I think that sends a message out that is also counterproductive, that essentially if we just talk tough enough, that something good will come out of that. And I think that there's a real lack of substance in what the GOP candidates did, and more alarmism than anything else.
Hmm. Well, let's move on now, if we can, and talk about some of the week's other news that really hit home here in Massachusetts. First and foremost, there is a new documentary out. It's called Heroin, Cape Cod, USA. And this week, Governor Baker hosted an advance screening of the documentary for state legislators. It's going to air on HBO. And we have some reaction here from State Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters at the screening.
When you leave here tonight, make certain that you go home and hug the person you love most in your life and all the things that we're grateful for and for channeling our voices to change this epidemic with the urgency that it deserves.
So, Jabari Asim, let me start with you. I mean, this documentary is very, very powerful. It follows eight young people on the Cape who are in the grips of a heroin addiction. A couple of them actually die during the filming of the documentary. I mean, what do you think, what's your reaction to the fact that Governor Baker decided to turn to a documentary to show to state legislators as a means to accomplish what when it comes to his plan for conquering the opioid addiction crisis?
Well, sometimes I think, you know, the visual impact of something like a film can be so much more substantive and overwhelming than our words, however carefully crafted. But one of the things that really struck me in the piece was that it raised a lot of questions that I didn't necessarily know about heroin and heroin addiction, and I think that's one of the ways that it will be particularly illuminating. I mean, my eyebrows shot to the top of my head a number of times just looking at different bits of information that I wasn't necessarily aware of.
Such as? You have an example?
The idea that there is all of this availability of cheap, potent heroin. I had no idea that it was accessible as it is, apparently.
Yeah. The film also goes a long way to sort of being sort of an honest witness to the lives that these young people lead in terms of how they got into addiction, the effects that the addictions have on not only them but their families, but also that they're not, quote unquote, you know, the typical or the expected kind of person who becomes an addict. I mean, we have a clip from Heroin Cape Cod USA here, and it features a young man in the film. His name is Daniel, and he's talking about in this clip why he first started using heroin.
I did drugs because they were fun and because it was a way to connect with people. I didn't do drugs growing up because I was depressed or because I was sexually abused or because I have, you know, issues. Like, I might be depressed now because of where my life is, but I wasn't a sad kid.
John, so here's my question for you. I mean, it's hard to hear that stuff. This is a really tough documentary to watch. But on the other hand, the problem is so epidemic in Massachusetts right now that I would imagine that a lot of these state legislators have heard from their very own constituents, families, you know, who have been calling out for help for the state to do more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's an estimated 4 deaths a day from heroin overdoses in Massachusetts, and that's a big problem. One of the things that this movie emphasizes is the movement from prescription painkillers to heroin. And the estimate is that 80% of heroin users started with prescription painkillers. So this whole scenario of someone has an accident, they get a prescription for painkillers, they start abusing them, and then they wind up using heroin is a narrative thread that goes throughout the documentary. And I think that one of the main issues here to deal with is the prescription drug overuse that Governor Baker has addressed. He has legislation pending on Beacon Hill that would limit first-time prescriptions to 72 hours for mm-hmm. painkillers.
He's been getting some pushback from that from various parts of the medical field.
He has been. And part of it, the reason is he's also got this controversial 72-hour hold against their will for drug users. And that's getting a lot of pushback as well from a civil rights standpoint. But I think that there are so many aspects to this that unless there's some kind of concerted, coordinated effort to deal with both this and other drug use, that it's going to be very hard to stem this. And one last thing just on what Jabari said. Nobody knows how powerful the heroin is anymore. Mm-hmm. So some of these situations occur because people don't realize that the potency of the heroin, it can be far greater than they expected. So there are all kinds of aspects of this that need to be addressed.
It's ultra potent and ultra cheap, too, mm-hmm. as you were pointing out, Jabbar. I mean, one young woman in the movie who, you know, looks like she's on the road to recovery. She has children, and she, you know, she tells the camera that, like, her kids are her reason to live and to stay sober. She ends up dying of an overdose of heroin and fentanyl. I mean, it's just heartbreaking to see. But Jabari, I'm wondering, you know, a piggyback off what John's saying here, and I kind of come back to this question of, do you think it's, you know, an effective lobbying tool to use a film like this on Beacon Hill?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of applaud the daringness of it. You know, I can do a white paper, I can put out a policy position, and I can be absolutely correct. But I think that a film, especially you've got an Oscar-winning director who put this documentary mm-hmm. together, it's very intimate, it gets really close up into the lives of these users, and I think that it can convey a lot of information effectively in a short amount of time.
There is a minority opinion here. Cape and Islands District Attorney Michael O'Keefe was quoted the other day saying, you know, this idea of accident, prescription, abuse, heroin, is a small fraction of the universe of heroin addicts, that many, many heroin addicts come through marijuana, alcohol, other drugs, and arrive there. So his point is to just think that this is a one-dimensional problem is problematic. And his other point is there's going to be a ballot question next November on legalizing marijuana. And what he says is when you consider that ballot question, consider also the heroin epidemic, because he believes that it's a gateway drug and it's much more prevalent than the situations that are shown in the documentary.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's sort of shift gears here for a minute and zoom out back to a big national story, because it's one that that deserves a lot of thoughtful conversation, I think, because it comes out of Baltimore, of course, and this has to do with the death of Freddie Gray, because the trial for William Porter, he was the first of six police officers charged in Gray's death, ended up in a hung jury this week. So on Wednesday, Judge Barry Williams ended up declaring a mistrial for Porter. We have some tape here from NPR's Jennifer Ludden. She told All Things Considered that while no one expected a mistrial, many people have commented on the complications or the complexity of the case.
Legal analysts have always said this is a really tough case. You know, this is not an officer, police officer shooting someone in the back, as some of these, you know, videos that we have seen come out. This was an officer charged for what he did not do.
And just to remind folks, Freddie Gray died due to wounds or injuries received while he was being arrested, and he died in a police van. So, Jabari Asim, your first response to this mistrial in the hung jury?
Well, you know, I lived in Baltimore for 3 years, so I've had some firsthand encounters with the police there, but I know how intense the issue is. But I think that what's sort of being minimized in this discussion is that though it was a form of negligence that resulted in Freddie Gray's death, it was also deliberate. In Baltimore, that particular technique is known as a rough ride. It's not a secret. People are aware of it. It's one thing you want to avoid. You don't want the police to give you a rough ride. And I'm hoping that it's not a missed opportunity, that we don't get caught up in whether or not the police followed policy, but it raised the question of whether they deliberately didn't follow policy.
John?
And that's very hard to prove in court. You know, there are six court cases, six prosecutions that are surrounding this death of Freddie Gray. And this was the easiest one, or not the easiest one. This was the least of them, I think. And they started out in part to get William Porter, who was the one on trial here, to enable them to use him as a witness in the other cases. Mm-hmm. And so this throws a real big monkey wrench into the whole proceeding, because the next trial is supposed to start January 6th. So it's a complicated, difficult case to prosecute. And this one was the one that was the fuzziest, I think, of all, and the lowest charges of all.
The manslaughter charges versus the higher murder charges.
Exactly.
Which some of the other
so I think that this doesn't bode all that well for the prosecution going forward and what they do. And here's the last problem that they have, or another problem they have. In his closing statement, the prosecutor said that William Porter is a liar. How are they going to bring him best case scenario, back to testify in the other cases if they've already branded him a liar. It's incredibly complicated and very difficult to unravel.
Well, another layer of complication here, and Jabari, I'd love your perspective on this, is Porter, Officer Porter, is a black officer. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's officers of multiple races being charged amongst the six. And I just wonder... So obviously this isn't just an issue of white police officers and young men of color, but the police writ large and communities of color. But does it make any difference that Porter was a black officer?
I don't think so, because I think if you're familiar with Baltimore and many of the incidents that happen in Baltimore, they don't necessarily involve white police officers. They involve police officers. And, you know, this is the first time an officer has been prosecuted in one of the high-profile cases. We're talking about, like, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, et cetera. It's happened before. I mean, it's hard enough just to get a trial. And so some people are trying to see a victory in the fact that there is a trial. But I think we've been through that before. I mean, as far back as Amadou Diallo in 2000.
Right.
Where,
in New York. Yeah.
Right. It was like, well, oh, we got a trial, which is unusual. But, you know, people are tired of that. And they're beginning to wonder, is this going to be six instances in which no one goes punished for the rough ride?
Mm. And so what do you think the effect of this first trial ending up in a mistrial could have on the five more that are supposed to follow?
Well, I think John is absolutely right in that they've sort of compromised their case by establishing that the one defendant that they hope to use to testify against the other defense, not only can he now decline to testify by relying on the Fifth Amendment, but they've also attempted to discredit him in court. Mm. So it is going to be much harder. It was already hard. It's going to be that much harder now.
Yeah. Well, let's take a couple minutes to shift gears once again and come back to Massachusetts and talk about an issue which, honestly, I thought we had put to rest a couple years ago, John, but apparently we haven't, and that is casinos in Massachusetts. Because before the Plainridge Park Casino opened, budget analysts predicted that the state's first casino would generate $262 million annually. Later, they revised their estimate downward to $160 million annually. So that's quite a significant reduction in tax revenue for the state. And John, as we all remember, tax revenue was what we got sold on in Massachusetts for these casinos.
Exactly. So this is a bad moment for legalized gambling. The tax revenue is estimated to drop from $128 million to $78 million. And one of the issues is, should Massachusetts be in this business at all? They seem to be not doing a very good job of organizing it. They have two casinos that won't be possibly be completed until 2018. They've got a potential casino down in Taunton that has a lawsuit against it, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, that could take 6 years to actually reach court. This is a mess, and it looks like Massachusetts has boggled this from the very beginning. I think that it's a real testament to how badly thought out this was, that they jumped in here. Plainridge is 11 miles away from Twin Rivers in Rhode Island.
I was just going to say, this one was supposed to be the no-brainer.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they have 4,000 slots versus 1,250. Their projected revenue is being revised upward. They're doing a lot better. So they're going in the opposite direction of Plainridge. So I think that it bodes ill for the state in terms of trying to generate this cash cow that they thought was going to be an easy, pretty easy lift.
Yeah, I mean, Jabari, I keep remembering that over and over again, folks who are in support of casinos said, all this money is, these are Massachusetts gamblers leaving the state.
Right.
So we got to keep the money in the state. Well, apparently, as John just pointed out, they're still leaving the state here. So what do you think, what implications do you think this has for the casino or legalized gambling industry in Massachusetts and for state revenues as a whole?
Well, I mean, it raises certain questions for me. I used to live in Missouri, and Missouri had that same argument. We're losing all this tax revenue to casinos in Illinois. We have to get gambling in Missouri. And unfortunately, I moved from Missouri before they actually established casinos. Yeah. But it raises the question, and just listening to John, I'm wondering, are there states in which casino revenues actually meet the projections? Is it working somewhere? I mean, you pointed out that in Rhode Island, that particular casino is doing well. So I'm wondering, are there states that are doing it right? What would lead states to be so optimistic in the first place?
Well, certainly Atlantic City is not doing all that well.
And I Nevada mean, seems
they've
to
got
be doing
casinos
well
closing
too.
Yeah. A hand over well. Fist there. So, okay. So I think it, I'm not sure the gambling moment has vanished, but I think that there's an oversaturation at this point, and I think that that Massachusetts is getting in on the tail end of something that was lucrative before that's not necessarily going to be lucrative going forward.
Or at least not necessarily lucrative in the way that the state has gone about,
right.
about it, because we still don't even have those other casinos yet, at least, you know, brick and mortar built on the ground. There's ideas for them. I mean, and the thing that really gets me is this is the state that has the nation's most successful lottery. So in terms of gambling writ large, Massachusetts, the state, knows how to do it. But casino gambling, this is just... It is. I don't. I'm looking for an analogy or a metaphor. It's not coming to me. We can't just seem to do it right.
It's they don't seem to have the knack, and I think you know, it would take a lot to turn this around. I think.
Yeah. Well, we just got a couple minutes left, which is just enough time for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the newscast, as we might say, but are worth a mention anyway. So, Jabari, let's start with you. What's your hubbub for this week?
I was curious about the rather muted response to Tom Brady's expressed support for Donald Trump. In my travels, it seems to me, not being a native Massachusetts person, that Tom Brady is the quarterback that people love to hate. And when I saw this, I said, boy, they're going to pile on the way they did about the inflated footballs and all that. Right.
Yes.
And but I haven't seen that degree of volume or venom, and I'm surprised.
Why are you surprised, though?
Because it seems like they're always looking for an opportunity to pile on this guy. So I thought, oh, you said this, man. They're just waiting to jump on Tom Brady about.
Although
this.
Many of who knows, maybe people might be, you know, Donald Trump supporters.
That might very
and now
well,
they've
that
got
might,
Brady on their side.
That might very well be the case. Unfortunately, well,
check out yesterday's New York Daily News front page. You'll see somebody who piled on Brady pretty good.
I'm gonna have to Google.
Yeah, I've been
right
paying attention
now.
To social media, and social media is pretty quiet on this.
Okay, you give me your hubbub. I'm gonna look for the New York Daily News.
Okay,
right.
Good,
now.
Good. So in honor of Plainridge, my hubbub is kind of an attorney general roulette. So former Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley was in California the other day testifying before a state organizational committee about DraftKings, which she represents, and the sports fantasy companies in general. And she was testifying about the regulatory approach and did a compare and contrast between current Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, who has adopted a sort of a go-slow approach, and let's see how we approach this, and New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman,
right.
who has done a go-fast approach and is trying to shut down DraftKings and its main competitor, FanDuel. The kicker is that California Attorney General Kamala Harris is also studying this, and to see what kind of regulation should go through. And guess who gave her $2,700 for her U.S. Senate campaign earlier this year?
I dare not.
That's correct, Martha Coakley. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting sort of scramble here for what's going to happen to these sports fantasy companies. But I think Martha Coakley has a little bit of a maybe a PR issue here.
Okay, so I'm going to... Just I did Google the New York
you
Daily News.
You can't read it, can you?
I can't actually read it. No. I cannot read it on the radio, what the New York Daily News had to say about Tom Brady and his support for Donald Trump. So listeners, Google it yourself. It's not safe for the radio, but it's a classic Daily News front page. Well, my hubbub is a really, really quick one. I want to give a hat tip to the students at Olin College because they are just fabulously creative there. Looks like they may be trying to program a robot that may have a conscience. They're thinking about firefighting robotic dogs that sacrifices themselves to rescue people, things like that. So file that under cool things coming from Massachusetts, maybe in a year or two to come. With that, that's the end of our week in review today. And I just want to say many thanks to John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University. Thanks so much for joining us today, John.
Nice to be here.
And Jabari Asim, executive editor of The Crisis Magazine. It was great to have you, Jabari.
Thank you.
There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.